views on this program are opinions of dentist industry experts and do not constitute personal financial advice. This program is furnished by Dentist Advisors, a registered investment advisor. You're tuned into Dentist Money Industry Expert Series. Now here's your host, Reese Harper.
Welcome to the Dentist Money Show. I'm your host, Reese Harper, here on the Industry Expert Series with someone who's going to help us a lot today, understanding how to transition a practice from the buyer or seller side. Mr. Matt Porter, everybody. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you.
Yeah. What's up, Matt?
Not much.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your background. I've known you for a while, so I don't really need to know it. Well, for the listeners, let's go through where you've been. You've got a pretty interesting experience and some great knowledge that I think you bring from different industries too. So tell me how you got into this and where you've been since you graduated.
Sure. I hope it's not too self-indulgent, but if I spend a little bit of time explaining the background, what I do now may make a little bit of sense.
Yeah, do it.
My grandfather was a CPA for 40 years. My dad was a CPA for 35 years. And
very interesting people.
Just kidding. Thanksgiving dinner was super entertaining. And so I knew for whatever reason I didn't want to be a CPA, but it's always been in my DNA. In fact, I used to help my dad during tax season, you know, doing data entry on the tax returns. So I went to college. I got a degree in construction management, and I went to work for a national home builder.
Okay.
I spent about 12 years with a national home builder and developer.
You were swinging a hammer?
No. I started out as a superintendent, worked my way up to director of operations. So I ran construction customer service, land acquisition for a unit of about a couple hundred employees, a $50 million a year P&L. And during that time, I went back to school and did an executive MBA program, nights and weekends for a couple years.
Right.
And I established a network. I had a couple good friends that I met during that time and stayed in close contact. And that was over a decade ago. And then a couple years ago, as I've been enjoying my career, enjoyed the industry of home building, my two friends, Rich and Tanner, who were buddies from MBA, were in dental commercial real estate, specialized in helping dentists buy their building, sell their building, negotiate a lease with a landlord. They came to me about a year and a half, two years ago, and said, hey, we've got a great business opportunity. There's so much synergy. We cross-pollinate a lot with dental transitions because every dental transition, when you buy or sell a practice,
there's usually real estate involved.
There's always real estate. Whether you're buying the building, selling the building, even assuming a lease, you have to negotiate the lease assumption with the landlord and the seller of the practice.
Yeah.
So they've bumped up against those so often and said, hey, we want to grow the business and add a complementary business line in transitions. Matt, come join us. And I kind of laughed at them. I knew very little about dental per se. And I said, that's crazy. That's a niche of a niche of a niche.
Yeah.
There can't be enough business.
Uh-huh.
And they said, trust us, there is. And I've known these guys for a long time. And what really drew me to the opportunity was the chance to be an entrepreneur. My MBA emphasis was in entrepreneurship. So to have my own company. And what also drew me was the opportunity to work with two guys of great character. To me, what you do is only surpassed by who you work with.
Yeah, the culture of where you work has a lot to do with how much you love it, right?
Yep. So cool. It was a completely counterintuitive decision for me to leave a great corporate job and start a new business line in something that I had relatively little experience in.
Yeah. You had a lot of good technical background. You had a lot of accounting background. You've had an MBA. You've been running a pretty complex financial operation in a home builder. I mean, it's one of the most underappreciated financial operations, right? I mean, finance and home building is more closely related than almost anything else can be with finance, right? But people assume that home building has more to do with hammers and nails, when a lot of it's just behind the scenes. There's a ton of complexity when it comes to every dollar and cent, right?
That's true. The company that I worked for did over $1 billion a year in revenue.
Yeah.
And that's a lot more than hammers and nails and 2x4s.
Totally, man. Well, let's talk a little bit then about, like, as you got, you started this company. It's been how long now since you guys started Menlo Transitions?
I think I assembled the desk, you know, folded the chair, plugged in the phone, sharpened the pencils, and sat down about 18 months ago, and that was day one.
It's gone a lot better than you, it's probably as good as you could have hoped, right?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, you guys have done a really nice job in building relationships and building a lot of trust in the community. And so tell me a little bit about, let's get to what we think might be the most helpful for listeners, now that they've got a little bit of background. What, in your opinion, are some of the biggest mistakes that buyers or sellers make, you know, when transitioning a practice? What are the, kind of some of the faux pas that you consistently run into where you think if this guy or gal would have started thinking about this 5 years ago, this would have really helped?
I would say let's start from the buyer segment.
Okay.
Because a lot of times buyers almost default into buying a practice because they're disillusioned with the current position that they're in as an associate, maybe working at a corporate group, and they want more autonomy. They feel like they want more money, and that comes through practice ownership. Therefore, find a practice, and it's ready, fire, aim.
Yeah.
I just jump into that practice, and I see a couple of things that are overlooked. Probably one of the most key mistakes or misconceptions that I see is oversimplifying the valuation. And here's what I mean by that. There's a metric that's proliferated out there as being the one quick, easy, dirty metric to value practice, and that is?
A percentage of collections.
Ding, 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 ding,
yeah.
Ding.
Yeah.
You are a winner.
But it's not that simple, is it?
It's not. And this is where it ties into my background, both from having the CPA DNA, if you will, mm-hmm. and then understanding complex financial models and valuations and doing appraisals and valuations on a $30 million investment for a real estate development. I looked at it from a cash flow perspective and a net profit and the qualitative factors that go into it. When you're buying a piece of real estate, you look at location, proximity, demographics, surrounding competition.
Yeah.
None of that seems to be evaluated when you distill it down to an oversimplification of percent of collections.
Yeah.
And so I see that happen all too often where we'll look at the collections and say, 75% of collections. And that doesn't even begin to tell the story. And
yeah, there's a lot of factors that go into evaluation, right? I mean,
that's exactly
I don't think people often, there's probably a range that if you applied a range, let's say you're collecting $1 million and you're a general dentist and you've heard that that you can bank on a percentage of collections. Let's say it's 70%, 60%, 65%, 80%, whatever the number is that you've been told. There probably is a range somewhere between 40 and 80 or 50 and 90 or 55 and 100 of collections or 100% plus, you know. But a lot of it really depends on 7, 8, 10 different factors. At some point, though, it's kind of frustrating for dentists because they try to apply that simple metric and then, you know, don't really have a good handle on what their practice probably is worth. And it's probably just important to keep all these factors in mind. So let's list a few of them, like what could change the value of a practice. One of them you said was how much net income it has or what it actually makes. If I collect $1 million and I'm making $150,000, it's much less valuable than if I'm making $300,000 off of my million or $400,000 or $500,000 off my million, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
What are some other factors, man, that kind of come to mind?
So there's both, I categorize them in two columns. There's qualitative and quantitative factors. Even in the quantitative, the numeric, there's collections, there's net income, there's cash flow, profitability. But then in the qualitative side, you want to look and see, is it a digital practice? Are you going to have to convert and upgrade to digital? What kind of equipment is there? Are the chairs 0 to 2 years old, 2 to 7 years old, over 7 to 15? If they're over 15 years old, you're going to have to make a capital investment. You're going to have to invest some more money into the practice up front,
yeah.
which decreases the initial cash flow.
Yeah. Location. Age of practice, you said?
Age of practice.
Yeah.
Age of patients.
Age of patients, average
because
age.
Because if your patients are aging with the practice, aging in place, like most practices are, if there's not a mind kept a new patient and continually cultivating a new patient base, the doc's retiring. Well, most of those patients are in retirement age as well, and that's not going to provide a stable income for a young 30-year-old dentist looking to own a practice that's going to support them for the next 30 years.
Yeah. Location of the practice is a big one too, right?
Yep, definitely. I mean, location, both in terms of competition, barriers to entry, but also accessibility, signage.
Yeah, traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about collections trending? You know, how does that affect it?
Good question. I get really concerned when I see a downward collections trend. Mm-hmm. The metric that I try to use, a good benchmark, is more than 10% decline from the previous year. There's a red flag there. There's something going on.
Yeah.
Or if you've seen more than 3 years in a row of a steady decline, that's also indicative of an underlying problem.
Makes sense.
So to go back to the percentage of collections for 1 minute, just to circle back, coming from an outside perspective into the market, I was very frustrated because revenue doesn't really tell you if the practice is going to make enough money to help pay your student loans, pay the practice loan, and take enough home to your family. But I understand that there is a place for it, because unlike a car, if I'm going to sell you my car, you and I go on Kelley Blue Book and we type in the make, model, year, you know, right down to what kind of seats they have, what kind of headlights, and you and I are going to be within $50 as a buyer and seller of having a conversation about what the fair price is.
Yeah.
If you're going to buy my house, we can go look at 100 or 200 comps of house of similar bedroom, bathroom count, square footage in a zip code in a 3 mile radius, and you and I are within $10,000 or $20,000 of having a reasonable conversation as a buyer and seller and finding middle ground. How do you do that on a practice?
Yeah.
Are there comps? Do you have a data point? Do I have a data point? This is usually the first time you're selling a practice, first time I'm buying a practice.
Yeah.
It's so challenging. And I find that a lot of times the expectations start so far apart. You want $900,000 for your practice. I think it's worth $600,000. I'm going to tell you, there's no way to bridge a $300,000 gap in expectation.
So I think at some level, what you're saying is there's a place, I think, where a lot of people, this, in my experience, I guess, I need to know the value of a practice throughout my life a little bit in order to know that my expectations are correct when it comes time to sell. But I usually don't get my valuation done until right before I'm going to sell, in which case I'm kind of stuck with some emotions that may be positive in some cases, but usually they're probably feeling negative about their valuation because they've overvalued what they have, right?
That's right.
It's more
That's
common
right.
to overvalue what you've got, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, no one wants to sell it short. But I think if you're doing retirement planning, or if you're trying to understand, you know, in our case, you know, in our practice, we really do need to know approximately what someone's going to be receiving at retirement in order to know how to invest their money today. If we invest their money today thinking they're going to have $400,000 from the practice sale at retirement, it'll change what type of investments we actually pick for the individual doctor. So do you think that people should probably approach formal appraisals more frequently than they do throughout their career? You know, or is it okay to just use a rough range and kind of ballpark it until you get close to retirement?
I would say a rough range is probably good on an annual basis.
Okay.
But then maybe every couple years,
get a
formal
good appraisal
done. Because here's the other thing that the formal appraisal is going to do. It will help you reverse engineer to where you want to be,
right?
Hey, if I'm your client and I say, hey, I need to sell my practice for $900,000 and the formal appraisal says $750,000, well, then any good appraiser will also give you measures and steps to take to help grow it to that 900 number.
I agree. I think too often, I mean, this is their biggest asset. We talk about, like, let's say an average person, I mean, our average client, the income tends to be higher than the national average just because financial services, a service provider, they end up working with guys that are doing a little bit better than the average. And I think it probably is because people that do better than the average seek out advice from a good appraiser, a good consultant, a good financial advisor, so they end up making more money. But ultimately, if you can know in advance of your retirement, at several points in your career, what your practice is really worth and these benchmarks that the appraiser gives you to hit. It's your biggest asset, and when you do sell that, it converts to a type of money that's really hard to come by for most dentists, which is after-tax cash that's sitting there that you're not taxed on again, you know. And most of the retirement income people get is from their 401k and SEP IRAs, simples, and cash balance plans. And so they get to retirement, and the only thing they've saved for retirement is this 401k or whatever they've been doing. And then they sell the practice, and it's their biggest form of after-tax cash that they're ever going to get. And it allows them to kind of decide each calendar year what their income tax is going to be. Because when you pull money out of the 401k, you get taxed on it. And when you pull money out of this practice sale bucket, you're not. And so you can kind of decide each year how to manipulate your income to make sure that it stays low on average throughout your retirement. But I'm worried that people delay getting an appraisal until too late, and they don't improve the parts of their practice that would increase the valuation until too much time has passed. And you know, they don't, when they're 40, they don't think it's time to get an appraisal because not selling for 15 years. And I think it's underappreciated, you know, this regular valuation process.
And I tell you, there's nothing more disheartening than sitting down with a client who's in their 60s and they say, okay, now I'm ready to retire, go sell my practice. What should we sell it for? And I give them that valuation. They say,
it's not enough.
You can see in their face, you can see their stomach drop, and they say,
it's like
I've got to keep practicing.
I know, it's like the first time they've ever thought about it. And it's like,
it's
this
horrible.
Is your biggest asset. You need to know what it's worth throughout your career, because it will have major implications on the other financial decisions you're going to make along the way.
That's right.
It'll affect how you invest your money, which accounts you put it in. It'll affect your time frame, how fast you could pay down your real estate, which house you can actually afford to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so important. It's the biggest source of cash for most of these guys, and they just don't think about the valuation until 2 months before they're about to sell.
Yep.
It's so sad. All right, man. So talk about tips going forward. If you can say, I mean, one of those that we just probably just really hit on, but let's talk about major takeaways that you'd want people to have as they think about valuation and transitions. You know, this one right here we probably just hit, which is you're getting appraisal more frequently than just once in a career, right?
Right.
Is that one?
That's a good one. That's a good one to start with.
Yeah.
Other tips or advice from a buyer's perspective?
Yeah, let's do that.
As you're looking at practices, take your time.
That's a good point.
Sometimes you'll feel rushed into a decision. The guy or gal selling their practice may have had a life event or something that's encouraged them to retire quickly. Don't let that force you to skip your due diligence.
Proper due diligence.
Absolutely.
How many practices, I mean, for the biggest purchase they ever make, do you feel like sometimes there's very little due diligence done?
Yes, and it amazes me. I think about it logically, and I say, if I have a practice that's closing in 2 weeks, over $1 million, and the buyer is fretting over spending $3,500 to have an attorney review the purchase contract on it, and I'm thinking, if you're borrowing $1.2 million, is a good insurance policy to pay $3,500 to have a licensed, seasoned attorney that's familiar with dental transitions look it over and give you some good sound advice?
Yeah.
Because if you make a bad mistake on that practice purchase, it takes a good 5 to 7 years for you just to fix the mistakes.
Yeah.
And that's a long time in a career where you need to be making hay while the sun shines and you're trying to recover from a mistake that was made. There's such a mentality of trying to save every cost you can and not having a good financial advisor, CPA, appraisal done, attorney review a contract. All told, from a buyer's perspective, I don't want to oversimplify, but maybe $7,000 to $12,000 for all those advisors to look at it and give you good specific advice.
Yeah.
And in the long run, it's money that's well spent.
Yeah, completely.
I get why they don't.
Yeah.
If I was a dentist and I have $400,000 in student loans, I also have a mortgage. I bought a house. I have kids. I'm an associate somewhere. So I have another $400,000 mortgage. There's $800,000 in debt. And then I'm taking on another $1.2 million in debt. I'm going to try and, you know, save and scrounge and you know, cut every expense everywhere I can as well.
Yeah.
But that's not the place to cut it.
No, it's not. I mean, if you...
Reese, this isn't a plug. I don't do any of those services. I'm not the attorney that reviews the contracts. I'm actually, the most of the time, the broker selling the practice or providing appraisal. But I say that just out of concern and care for a buyer to make good, educated, methodical decisions.
Yeah, these are two really good ones. So first, we said, you know your valuation well in advance of selling so you can identify things to improve in advance of selling.
Yep.
Second, don't be afraid to spend money on advice, especially as it relates to the legality of the contract that you're entering in with the buyer or seller. Make sure you look at the tax implications of the transaction. Make sure you look at talk to a financial advisor and make sure you can afford the payments, that the cash flow is not going to be too tight. Your CPA could probably help with that as well. If you're retiring, make sure you know what to expect from a financial advisor. So seek advice from people. One thing I was going to ask you that, from my perspective, I see happening, and I don't like I don't have a dog in this particular hunt, but I see people trying to negotiate the sale of their practices on their own. In a lot of cases, it results in they feel like they made money because no one was involved as an intermediary. And I get it. I mean, there is some fee pressure on transitions. I mean, and it can seem like a lot of money when you look at, sometimes it feels like the work that's being put in by some brokers may not be that significant, right?
Yep.
But the reality is that when you negotiate your own transaction, there is a lot of room for you not to get the deal that you think you might be getting by just avoiding paying someone to get involved.
Yes.
You see a lot happen with real estate transactions. I mean, there's a reason that brokers exist. There's a reason they make a living, and that most people value them to a great degree, because they remove that emotional barrier between you and the buyer, or you and the seller, and make the transaction happen in a way that's favorable to your, you know, in your best interest. And it's sometimes people just think that by avoiding paying people, they're going to get a better deal. And I don't always see that happening. Yesterday I was at the show here at the WRDC, and someone told me that they didn't hire a broker, that they negotiated the sale of this practice on their own. And I don't know if it was a good deal or not. I was told that it was a good deal, but it was in Scottsdale, which is a fairly competitive market, and as a percentage of collections, it was pushing near 100% of collections. Now, it better be a really, really good practice in order to be worth that, but the attitude that this buyer had was that he had negotiated an extremely good deal on this general practice in Scottsdale, and it was that he avoided hiring a broker, he's avoided paying a commission to anybody, and been able to get this and structured in a way that, and I'm just questioning in my mind. I'm like, those numbers to me, I haven't seen a transition at that ratio of collections in that market ever. And so all I got to do is just look at it and go, okay, I guess it was a good deal, but it doesn't smell right to me. I mean, it just seems like this is an example when a broker getting involved could give the buyer some rationale to hold off or rethink this, or let's
provide other options, alternatives.
You feel like you're stuck into one deal.
Yeah.
You know, but buyers get emotional and they want what they have their heart set on. And sometimes I feel like they way overpay.
Back where I'm from, we call that stepping over a dollar to pick up a dime.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, yeah, it's a big dime some days.
Yes, it is. I see that. I understand there's a place for doing the DIY.
Mow your own lawn,
right?
Once in a while.
DIY is taken over, and there's a lot of things we can do it ourselves and feel good, and it's intrinsically rewarding and maybe save some time and money.
Yeah.
That type of professional service, I think there's more value added by outsourcing a professional. Like, yeah. A CPA, for example. A good CPA will find enough tax deductions and tax savings to more than pay for their fee.
Yeah.
So it's basically like you got your taxes done for free because they made their value in the tax savings. Yeah. A financial advisor will provide wise investment strategies that more than pay for whatever that fee is.
Yeah.
It's been my experience. We've done 16 transitions in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
Most of those I can say that I've covered my fee in the increased value that I added, the price that I was able to get for the practice.
Yeah.
And then my services, you know, everything, marketing,
all the
practice,
time.
Showing the practice, the time, yeah. The negotiation, the expertise that I bring to the table, the facilitation was all just free.
Yeah.
And that's a great feeling.
Yeah. Well, man, it's good feedback. So we've got a lot of takeaways today. We've got, don't be afraid to outsource things that are essential. Don't be afraid to outsource things that to professionals that can add more value in some ways. Mow your own lawn once in a while, okay? That's okay. There's just some big things that really can.
There's a limit to the do-it-yourself mentality.
Yeah, and I feel like the time to, especially when it comes to a practice transition, it's the biggest purchase of your career, and a lot of people are doing it in their early 30s, mid-30s, late 30s. You know, they don't have a lot of financial experience at that point, you know, on the buyer side. And on the seller side, it's you're preparing for retirement. You're about to liquidate your biggest asset. There's just so much opportunity to make the deal happen the wrong way at both ends of those extremes, you know, of someone's career. So,
can I give one more piece of advice?
Yeah, go ahead.
That pertains to both buyers and sellers.
Yeah.
Don't argue over price.
Okay, yeah.
The single largest component of this transaction is goodwill. It's the intangible value of the practice. It's the loyalty that the patients and the staff have to the practice and the doctor.
Yeah, that's great advice.
And whether the practice is a little overpriced or underpriced, hopefully we've had a good intermediary, an independent third-party valuation or a broker that comes involved and provides some arbitrary value that's fair and in line. That way you and I as a buyer and seller can talk about things that matter.
Yeah.
Recare, patient treatment, you know, staff training and philosophy. But if you and I are arm wrestling over price, that goodwill that's the biggest part of the transaction just became badwill.
Yeah, exactly.
And nobody wins in that circumstance. No. Do you think I'm going to set you up to succeed as I'm going out the door? I'm going to leave the cupboards bare. I'm going to talk you bad to the staff, the patients, if you're going to lowball me on price.
When the patients come back to me, the seller that's left, and ask me if they should accept the treatment plan that you proposed, and they wonder if, you know, it's just there's a lot of goodwill that can go up in smoke.
So that's where my father-in-law has a great saying where he talks about majoring in the minors.
Yeah.
And if you're so focused on price, you're majoring in the minors.
Yeah.
You're so worried about price that you're going to spend a little bit more on helping buyer services, but don't make up for it by trying to negotiate on the overall price. And by the way, topic for next podcast, it's the net, not the price, that matters most. There are so many details of a practice transition, how accounts receivable are handled and tabulated, how patient credits are going to be handled, how is rework going to be treated. Am I going to stay back and work? If so, what's my compensation structure for that?
Yeah.
What's the asset allocation for tax purposes of the practice? Are we going to put it towards equipment or goodwill? All those things drastically change my net as a seller and your net as a buyer. So if we're focused on this top line number, the price, we lose track of all the other things that are important that really end up changing the bottom line more so than the top line number of the purchase price.
Yeah, I think it's good advice, like, generally to... When you're trying to learn about the service that someone's about to provide, don't ask them about price for a while. Okay? If you're about to buy an asset from somebody, don't let price be the first conversation point.
That's what I do when I see my dentist. He sits me in the chair. I say, whoa, no x-ray. How much?
How much, son? All right. Well, it's been a great interview, Matt. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. And we'll look forward to doing another one of these. We'll circle back on your birthday and maybe we'll do another one of these, see how things are going, okay?
My pleasure. Thanks, Reese.
How do people get in touch with you? How do they reach out if they want to learn more?
Three ways. You can call me. Our telephone number is 480-290-7720. Jump on the website, www.menlotransitions.com, like Menlo Park. Or nice. Go ahead and email me directly at matt@menlotransitions.com. Glad to help, glad to answer any questions, even if it's just a simple idea that you want to bounce off of me, I'm always up for it.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you coming on the show. We'll look forward to having another interview soon, man.
My pleasure. Thanks, Reese.